1989 and 1990 felt like a huge turning point in history, certainly at the time. The Berlin Wall came down, the Soviet Union broke apart, and it looked for all the world like liberal democracy triumphed, where both fascism and communism had failed. So what's the problem now? Our guest this hour writes of flaws built into liberal democracy, and his book title goes a step further. Why Liberalism Failed. Failed? Not workable? Fixable? We have many questions for author Patrick Deneen. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, and he's the author editor of several previous books, including The Odyssey of Political Theory. Pat Deneen, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First, let's establish what kind of liberalism failed. Are we talking about the kind that Rush Limbaugh is always complaining about, or the kind we mean when we say liberal democracies?
Yeah, more the latter than the former. This is often a point of confusion among people because we use the word liberal to describe a spectrum of our political our political makeup. But I really mean it. I'm a political scientist, political theorist by training, and I really mean the political philosophy that has its roots some 500 years in our past begins with, for example, the philosopher John Locke, who posits the idea that human beings can be understood to be creatures who exist in or understood in their purest form as creatures in a state of nature. It's this basic idea, the kernel of this idea, that I think is the real source of what has turned out to be many of our problems.
Well, so is it a problem just in the United States or in any liberal democracy anywhere in the world?
Well, I think it's especially a problem in the United States because America was the first country to be really found on this philosophy, but I do think it's become much more pervasive, especially I would say as the kind of American influence, not just the American influence, but the influence of this ideal of liberal democracy has become pervasive across certainly the developed world, Europe and elsewhere. So you were right when you started the hour by suggesting that in 1989, someone like Francis Fukuyama wrote that we had reached the end of history, and the end of history was liberal democracy, that was what the end of history was. And it strikes me that history may not be quite over yet.
Yeah, no kidding. This is the second, I should point out, in a Yale University Press series on politics and culture, and the series editors say in their preface that this is a radical critique. I mean, are you trying to push buttons here, or I mean, is this as dismal as it sounds at times in the book?
I think, there's doubtless some buttons that have been pushed. The book's been reviewed in a lot of places, and what I found to be interesting about it is that I'm getting attacked or criticized in very similar terms on both the right and the left. In the American political makeup, we tend to see sort of teams lining up and one side sort of going after someone and the other side defending that person. What I've really tried to do in this book is to say there's actually a deeper continuity between what we think of as our right, political right, and our political left. And that continuity lies in what I argue is a kind of a wedding of two things we think to be opposite. This idea of this individual, free, autonomous self that lies at the heart of the kind of liberal tradition. And that in order to realize this individuated self, it turns out that we actually need a pretty large state, a pretty extensive and powerful state structure, and that the more we get individualism, the bigger the state gets, in some ways, the more powerful the state becomes, the more it, in some ways, creates this condition of this radical individualism. So rather than being sort of polar opposites, as we would think of in our politics today, it seems to me that there's really a far deeper connection. And so, buttons are being pushed all over the place here.
That particular point you were just making, though, about individuals want more rights, and therefore it's going to take an act of the state to secure more rights, so the state has to be somewhat bigger. That's a really interesting one that comes up again and again in the book, and it made me think in terms of even somebody saying I want less government is asking for an action of government to create that situation, isn't he or she?
Well, I think there is this fantasy that if we had less government, we would all be free individuals. But of course, this was never really a part of the liberal philosophic project. At the very founding of America, right, so think of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence says, in order to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. that what John Locke understood was that we have these rights according to nature, but they're not secure. So to secure them, we need a state. And the more we want to be free, the more we want to, especially to experience ourselves as these individual, autonomous, liberated selves, the more we're actually going to need a powerful government to make that happen. And it's not just, of course, it's not just a powerful government. It's also a government that helps to create and undergird an extensive market, and increasingly a market that becomes globalized. And I begin the book by pointing out that the very tools that we require to become these free individuals, and we can name them here as partly the state and partly this globalized market, that increasingly, if you ask your average citizen, you know, what, how do you feel? Do you feel like a powerful person? They're likely to say, well, I don't feel like I control the state anymore, and I don't feel like I control this global market anymore. In fact, we often talk about them in terms of things, these entities that we no longer have any real control over. So there's a kind of paradox built into this liberal philosophy that I think we're seeing coming really into focus today.
Patrick Dineen, just a few moments before a break hitting, your first words answer the question of when you wrote this. It sounds like this was a project in the works for quite some time.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this for a decade, and maybe it's just the luck of the draw, but I published it at a time when I think a lot of people think actually maybe liberalism is failing as a result of some more current events. But it is a project that's been long in the making.
All right. The project is called Why Liberalism Failed. There is no subtitle, and it's a striking title, and it's going to get your attention, and it does. And there are some really significant arguments in the book that we'll get into in just a moment. Patrick Dineen is the author from the University of Notre Dame. We'll come back and talk more with him about why liberalism failed and get some context and perspective from you and your thoughts about it as we move through the hour here on the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Stay tuned. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about political systems in the world, in particular the last one that seems to be standing on a regular basis, which is liberal democracy. Patrick J. Dineen, a political scientist at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, says there are issues. His book is called Why Liberalism Failed. And again, this is not liberal as versus conservative in the American sense, but the broader sense of liberal democracies like ours. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we explore what the issues are with liberalism. And it looks like there are some things in its DNA from what Pat Dineen is saying that may cause issues. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I'm really struck by the phrase that you think liberal democracy failed because it was successful.
Yeah, so I think what the way we typically think in politics is that the way to fix something is to sort of make the thing more what it's supposed to be. And this is especially true of liberal democracy. There's actually a phrase from John Dewey, the problem with democracy can only be solved by more democracy. And I think that we have that view about liberal democracy. The problem of liberal democracy can be cured by more liberal democracy. But as you can probably tell by this point, my argument is actually that the more liberalism has in some ways become fully itself, and especially has realized the image of this liberated, autonomous, and free individual that it held once as a kind of model of what the natural human being looks like. And in particular, the more that we've relied upon the tools that we've instituted to make that creature come into being, because it's not easy to make someone free, and free, for example, from family and place and community and background and so forth, that those very tools in some ways now make us their subjects, and we find them controlling us. I'll give you an example of this. Notice how often when we speak of certain developments, we can talk about technology, for example, how we view them as inevitable and that they can't be stopped. I notice this a lot these days when we talk about the future of automation and that automation is going to put a lot of people out of work. And when we talk about, when you hear people talk about, they basically say, well, this is going to happen and there's really nothing we can do about this. And this is an odd thing for a people to say who consider themselves to be free, to consider themselves to be liberal citizens. So I find that this paradox and this irony to be really pervasive in our society today.
And you're right that fixing this takes effort and sacrifice in a culture that now diminishes both. So we don't think much of either effort or sacrifice. What do you think we value instead?
Well, what I think we have come to value as a civilization is this understanding of freedom that especially emphasizes the ability to do what we want, you know, short of harming someone else. That's always the standard. It's what John Stuart Mill called the harm principle, that you should be able to do what you want as long as no one's sort of being hurt in the process. And that's really become a kind of defining feature of what liberal democracy is today. But one of the things I try to emphasize in the book is that liberal democracy in some ways always needed a kind of corrective of an older understanding of liberty. And that understanding comes from antiquity, and it comes from the Christian tradition, which is that liberty is achieved when it's a form of self-discipline and a form of self-mastery. And you could say this lie at the heart of the idea of what democracy is. Democracy isn't just sort of doing what you want, or freedom isn't just doing what you want, but democracy is really literally self-governance, right? We make the laws that we then put ourselves under. To the extent that we see a kind of diminishment of real sort of hands-on democracy of the type, for example, that Alexis de Tocqueville said that he saw flourishing in America in the 1830s, the kind of town hall democracy, literally township democracy, and that we increasingly think most, if not all, of our politics takes place in Washington, D.C., it suggests the way in which we do experience our politics today as a kind of absence of a kind of self-rule, and a kind of self-imposed absence of self-rule as a consequence of our very pursuit of individual freedom.
Well, so when individual freedom extends to things like, well, I don't particularly want to vote or take interest in the political system, is that part of the ways, one of the ways in which the individual thrust hurts the common good?
Yeah, so what, the last chapter of the book is called The Degradation of Citizenship. And I actually focus on the way that in the kind of almost the founding fabric of the United States, and you know, I think you could extend this to other countries, but I'm especially focused on America, that in the founding fabric of the United States, there was really a kind of a design effort to encourage us to think of ourselves first and foremost as private persons, as people who would pursue our own interests. And to the extent that we participated in politics, it was a place where we would express our interests. And you know, think about the way that we typically think about what voting is. Voting is a way that you express your preference. It's almost described in similar terms as a marketplace. And we even run campaigns now as if they're like advertisements in the marketplace. And there's very little actual real discussion of what the common good is and what sacrifice would be demanded of citizens and not simply as consumers picking a product. The idea that somehow being a citizen may demand sacrifices that we all have to share, and that would be in some ways in the forefront of what we would talk about in our political campaigns. That's almost unthinkable in ways today. If we think about it at all, it would only be in a condition of war. But one of the striking things to me about the wars that we've been fighting now for the last more than a decade, is there's never been a single moment where we've really talked about the sacrifices that would be needed for us to fight a war. And in fact, if you remember back to George W. Bush following 2001, he said, just keep on shopping.
Right,
that's
go to
the
movies.
Help us fight this war. Yeah.
Patrick Deneen's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, political scientist at the University of Notre Dame. His book is Why Liberalism Failed, and we're talking about liberalism in the larger sense, liberal democracies, here on the Jefferson Exchange. You get into voluntarism and the loosening of many kinds of social bonds. Is this a feature of liberal democracy generally or just more specifically American?
Well, actually, we see these kinds of features all over the world, particularly the developed world today. If you look across any set of measurements of what we might think of as what has come to be called by the political scientist Robert Putnam as social capital, so the ways that you could say that bonds and relationships and ties that we form with each other, if you look at measurements of those various things, what you see is a real steady decline in almost every area where you might measure that kind of set of relationships. We could think about it in terms of the family, marriage rates, and the rates in which people are having children. You could think about it studies by my colleague here at Notre Dame, Christian Smith. He studies religious affiliation, so the likelihood of someone becoming a member of a church or staying as a member of their church into adulthood, you see real significant declines of affiliation with religions. The decline of identification with political parties is really markedly declining. And even if you look at kind of these measures as they move into kind of the millennial generation, so the young people that I'm teaching in my classes, they show signs of a lack of trust of other people and other human beings, a kind of a much looser sense of ties to other people. That might be partly the kind of technology that young people are being raised with and in. But I think you see these trends already existed over a very long term across generations. So if you go all the way back to the kind of the greatest generation, you already see this kind of movement over the last 50, 60 years to the point now where we are more like these selves who were described in the state of nature than perhaps ever in the history of humanity.
So very much untethered to each other. We haven't really replaced those bonds. I mean, the family, church, party, those things really haven't been replaced with other things?
Well, some people argue that it's sort of achieved through online communities today. I think there's a number of works that have come out recently. There's actually a wonderful book called Alone Together that describes... In fact, how loose the ties are among kind of online communities. You even use the word community when discussing something online. In other words, the extent that we tend to join things, we join them in as much as they have easy availability of exit, right? And I think that's one of the key features of a liberal society is not to have bonds that are too tight and that might hold us, but to create relationships that allow for easy exit, low barriers to exit. You might say that's a condition of freedom, but it's also in some ways kind of at the root of a kind of crisis of our society and our inability to form a common good and to form some sense that we're in we have a shared fate together as citizens in a common enterprise.
Now, the other shoe that drops after voluntarism in the book is war against nature. I mean, that seems... real harsh. I mean, not just a using nature, but a war against it.
Yeah. So, to me, the first feature of liberalism is what we've been talking about, which is freedom from other people, and to create the conditions for our liberation from those kinds of defining bonds with other people that would have been through family and through community and through church and so forth, and that we've used the tools, especially of the state and of the market, to liberate ourselves from those bonds. But very early in the effort to create the liberal order, you saw philosophers and theorists really articulating that in order to liberate ourselves completely, we not only needed to be free from other people, we needed to be free from the bonds of nature, the kinds of limits of nature. And we could say there's a good side to this, which is, you know, we want to combat illness and extend our lifespan and so forth. But there's a way in which you could say very early in the liberal project there was the view that nature was this kind of obstacle, to the achievement of the things that we wanted, and we needed to conquer nature. So you have figures ranging from Francis Bacon way back in the Renaissance, but even closer to our time and place, someone like the major American philosopher John Dewey, arguing that nature really needed to be considered as a kind of object of our efforts to conquer and to exert mastery over nature. And so this, I think, underlies especially the transformation and the place of special importance of science and technology in our society, that the efforts especially to expand human mastery of nature through science and technology became a really core feature of the liberal project.
We are talking about Patrick J. Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. And we mean liberalism in the broader sense, the liberal democracy sense, not the liberal versus conservative in America sense. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone, 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Thanks for waiting. Here's a call from Derek in Talent.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, maybe you can help me out here. When I contrast the social democracies of Northern Europe with the United States, it makes me wonder if it's not liberalism that's failing, but capitalism that's actually failing. And then I guess I'd also like you to address the question, did Marxism fail? Because I think some people would argue it was never appropriately tested. And I'll take my question on the radio. I'll listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for that. Appreciate it, Derek. And the argument he's making is one I've heard before, that Marxism was never actually used in its pure form, because what we called communism was not at all really close to what he was talking about.
Right. Yeah. So, in fact, in the book, and this is what really riles up a lot of my friends on the political right, I basically argue that what we call capitalism is essentially the economic handmaiden of the liberal project. And you could say, in just the way I was describing, that the success of capitalism has also bred its failures, its crisis. I have a chapter in the book called The New Aristocracy. And again, here's a kind of irony and paradox of liberalism, that liberal democracy came into being to displace the old aristocracy, right? Especially the idea that you should have a position in society because of what your parentage happened to be, what your lineage happened to be. So if you were born of a royal family, you were royalty, and if you were born of a peasant family, you were a peasant. And so on the one hand, liberalism was very successful at displacing the old aristocracy, and it almost has ceased to exist, you could say. I mean, there's maybe remnants of aristocratic forms in America still today in some ways, but it's almost entirely gone. But in its place, it created a new aristocracy, and it was now a kind of economic aristocracy. And here again, the irony is that increasingly your success in America depends not necessarily on the rank of your parents, but on the success of your parents. And so the children of parents who have typically gone to good schools and had good jobs and live in good neighborhoods with good schools, those are going to be children who are going to go on and get good places and good schools, like the one where I teach. And it's much harder for someone to break out of the kind of the social situation and the social ranking that we now have in a very different way. So I would say that capitalism is certainly one of the ways that now has created a crisis within the liberal order, but I don't see it as a contradiction of liberalism. I think it, in many ways, it has been one of the tools of liberalism to advance itself. As to the question about Marxism, I would say that, yes, it's quite clear that Marxism, certainly as it was tried in the Soviet Union, failed. But I would submit that it was probably destined to fail because, like liberalism, I think it's based on a false conception of human nature. I think human beings are not completely individualistic creatures, as liberalism imagines them, but we're also not collectivist creatures, as communism imagines us. We're not creatures that can sort of just say, I don't care more for my children than, or that I should not care for my children more than I might care for other people, or that I'm not somehow invested in property that I might possess. That the idea that we can sort of overcome the sense of selfhood that lie at the heart of communism, it seems to me, was as based on just as false an anthropology as liberalism is as well.
I wonder if maybe one of the issues is that the founders of the United States didn't have quite enough faith in what John Locke was talking about. I mean, there are certainly indications that they did still think in terms of elites as making good decisions. That's why we have the Electoral College. It's why we originally had U.S. senators elected by state legislators who are themselves elected. So a couple of degrees of removal from direct democracy. Is that one of the issues we face peculiarly in America, that maybe the founders didn't go far enough toward the Locke end of things?
I think that the founders in many ways were quite faithful to Locke. And what I was just saying earlier, they did want the mass of Americans to think of themselves largely in more private terms. And this was one of the reasons why they wanted to establish a political system that would kind of draw especially a smaller number of ambitious people to the political center, to what would eventually be Washington, D.C., and allow the rest of us largely to pursue our private pursuits. And that these people who would be drawn to the center, it would be their job to try to create a great nation, a nation with a very powerful military and ultimately a powerful state, kind envisioned by Alexander Hamilton, with a very powerful market, increasingly a national market and now a global market, and that this would be the condition of our freedom, and that we would reward these people with our votes if they fostered the conditions of our freedom. But the concern of a lot of the critics of the Constitution at the time of the so-called anti-federalists was that this would actually lead to the undermining of certain kinds of democratic energies and civic energies, that the emphasis upon private life that was to be the form of freedom that most of us were to pursue would actually lead to a kind of loss of, we could say, democratic muscles, that we wouldn't exercise those muscles, and we would become complacent, and we would rely upon these people to go to Washington and do the work of politics for us. And to the extent that we do see a kind of a disconnect in the country today, politically, not just as a matter of political parties, but the kind of sense of a distance between the people and their elected leaders, it shouldn't be to us a surprising consequence of the system that was established by our founding fathers.
The book is called Why Liberalism Failed. It is the work of Patrick J. Deneen, who is a professor, associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. We'll come back and talk more about the contents of the book and take more phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're visiting with Patrick J. Deneen, an associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. He's written a book that is evidently pushing buttons left and right in America. It's called Why Liberalism Failed, not liberalism in the sense of versus conservatism, but the larger idea of liberal democracies like the one in which we all live, no matter the ideology. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we explore whether exalting the rights of the individual creates less of a viable society. 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Charles, no town given, sent an email in. He says, interesting topic. It seems we're not accounting for the vast variety of actual liberal structures, particularly with reference to total population and whether or not the individual country comes from a history of self-determination or autocratic control. Switzerland, for example, as opposed to the UK and US. Thank you for that, Charles. Mike in Medford writes, I've been pretty discouraged by democracy. The vast majority of voters don't seem educated enough to direct the government. Modern politics requires knowledge in economics, public policy, and science. While I consider myself extremely progressive, voting tests don't seem that bad of an idea, writes Mike in Medford. P.S. Is a poli-sci graduate degree still a good academic path? A question for you, Patrick.
Great. Well, these are both great questions. It's actually interesting that your first email from Charles would mention Switzerland. We were just talking about the debates at the time of the American founding, and the critics of the Constitution often invoked Switzerland as an alternative model. They thought America should be more like Switzerland, which would be a much more decentralized, more sort of local, composed of more self-ruling local entities, which they thought could be some form of the states or even smaller units of the states. And I think precisely out of concerns for what Mike writes about, which is that if people don't sort of pay attention, and if they're not called upon to pay attention, if you're not frequently called upon to exercise judgment and deliberation about matters of shared common civic concern, so to be citizens, not just to have the status of citizens, but to have the activity of a citizen, that the likelihood would be that your civic muscles would atrophy. And so the critics of the Constitution actually argued that that the Constitution would foster a kind of a potentially disengaged and even ignorant populace, not because people aren't smart enough to be Democrats, but because it's like anything, it needs exercise. You need to work those muscles. And so to the extent that Mike is discouraged by democracy and would like voting tests and so forth, or probably would entertain that possibility, I would say what we really need are more opportunities, and we need to think hard as a society about how we would think about organizing and maybe even reorganizing society in such a way that we would be much more encouraged and indeed required to exercise our political muscles.
Required as in like in Australia where you have to vote?
Well, I think voting is like it's like a period at the end of a sentence.
Uh-huh.
we put a lot of emphasis on voting, but it seems to me that we need to have a lot more deliberation. There are lots of studies that actually show, when we think today about our political divide and the partisan divide in our country, I think part of that is the result of the fact that we actually do not deliberate as citizens in a face-to-face way. We do most of our politicking through media and through kind of spectator sports. And when people come together, and we know this just like, you know, from family dinners, and maybe hopefully we know this from family dinners, that you're not likely to be as nasty at a family dinner where you might have a disagreement with a sibling as you would be perhaps as an anonymous person on an internet website. I hope that's the case anyway. But that hearing arguments from the other side and weighing and deliberating over differences can actually have the effect of bringing us closer together. It's not always the case that this will be an outcome, but it's a far greater likelihood that deliberation can lead to a kind of the effort to forge what might be a different solution than we might have begun with when we came into a conversation.
Let's take a call here. We have Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Patrick Deneen.
Hi. Well, first off, I really don't like that word liberal. It's so amorphous. It's hard to pin down what it means. It means a lot of things to a lot of different people. And I don't think we have a democracy. It's a nice idea, and it'd be great if we did someday. But our system is totally corrupted by money and politics. And instead of a winner-take-all system where, you know, 49% of the people vote one way, and then the 51% person gets elected, and that means the 49% are not represented, doesn't make sense either. A proportional parliamentary system makes a lot more sense that isn't corrupted by large donations, as we all know that happens. And the lies and advertising, and there's so many flaws with our election system that we really don't have a democracy. And then as far as capitalism goes, we subsidize the fossil fuel industry, and industries are really harmful. And I'm a big proponent of what Paul Hawkins and Amory Lovins promoted in their Natural Capitalism book a few years ago, that basically makes it so all the external costs of a product are included in the price of a product with no subsidies. So if, in that case, we would, if we looked at gasoline, it would include the price of all the spills, to clean up all the spills, all the pollution.
So the cost would not be externalized anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the external costs would be included, and that makes so much more sense because then we would obviously transition toward clean, more sustainable methods, and products wouldn't be made that are useless pieces of junk that end up in the floating in the oceans and everywhere. So those are just some ideas that I've been thinking, and I appreciate this conversation. I'll listen on the radio.
All right. Thanks, Pam. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thoughts from you, Patrick?
These are really great points. I mean, just in the first instance, I use the word liberal in the title, liberalism, in a little bit more of the technical, philosophical sense. And I would be the first to agree that people use this in many different ways. But I am really drawing on a kind of philosophical tradition that does have a specific definition that I've tried to draw out today. But let me actually turn to the discussion about, in particular, the question of, you know, whether there are better ways to run our market, or what we call capitalism. And the caller, Pam, was right that, and we have so many, there is no pure market as such. We have lots of ways that we're subsidizing certain players and not subsidizing other players. And I think this is unavoidable. And I think we should simply put aside the idea that there's some kind of pure market. And we should really ask the question that I think Pam is asking, which is what kind of market is going to actually really benefit us as a society, as a commonwealth, that will support the common good. And not just us, but thinking generationally. And this is one of my indictments of liberalism itself, and I would include in this our form of capitalism, which is that it in particular, encourages a shrinking of our temporal horizon. It really focuses us on the present and discounts both the past and the future. And as a result, it makes us into sort of single-generation thinkers as opposed to multi-generational thinkers. So when we think of the common good, we have to think as well the common good for future generations. And so in the book, I actually say not only should we think about more local forms of politics because that makes us more invested as citizens, but we should frankly think about more local forms of markets because exactly what Pam's talking about, it's really easy to externalize costs when everything's invisible to us. And a globalized market is one that really allows for a lot of hiding of externalized costs. And it's a lot harder to externalize costs when it's close to home. We'll notice when those costs are externalized because they're going to come back and bite us. So it's not to say that we don't have a national and even global marketplace, but much more of what we should think about as our economic exchange should, in some way or another, and I would, you know, these are conversations I would love to see take place, should really think about taking place closer to home. And I really do embrace what's often thought about as kind of a movement on the left, which is to think increasingly about markets as a plural thing rather than market as a singular entity.
So several different levels of markets then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you know, you need certain global markets for some things. But again, in the same way that we talk about certain features of our lives as inevitable, we tend to talk about globalization as inevitable, that there's nothing that can be done to stop it. But there, maybe there's good reasons why why we should favor, at least give some kind of preference to more local forms of market, because those are likely to generate a kind of economic responsibility that it seems to me a globalized market seems to encourage the opposite.
Oh, so more like the local food and know your farmer and that sort of system where you've got a relationship with
the person? Yeah, absolutely. Like when you externalize costs on a local farm, you see it, right? You know it because you're polluting your river and you're dumping sewage into your water system and so forth. It's easy, a lot easier to externalize costs when it's not happening to you.
Indeed. Let's take a call here from Bill in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Patrick Dineen, the author of Why Liberalism Failed. Bill, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I do know my local farmer, but I have two questions. First is, what would happen if we tried to rewrite the Constitution? The second is, I've seen people get furious at people like Jefferson and Franklin for owning slaves, and I wonder why we still take somebody like Socrates seriously, who never spoke out against slavery or tried to abolish it.
All right, so a change in the Constitution and slavery. Thanks for the thoughts on that, Bill. Patrick, your responses?
Right. Well, in the first place, I just want to defend the honor of Benjamin Franklin, who did not own slaves. Jefferson, of course, was a different matter. So there was a mixed view on this, obviously, at the time of the writing of the Constitution. And we did fight a civil war over this, and I think that question has been resolved. I hope that question's been resolved. No, the question about rewriting the Constitution is an interesting one, and there are proposals about trying to change the Constitution. I think you could do a lot of things short of rewriting the Constitution. I would be, at this point in our country's history, would be very nervous about opening up, like creating a new constitutional convention. If you think our campaigns are bad, imagine what we would be likely to see with a new constitutional convention. I think it would be a bloodbath, maybe literally. So I think there are lots of things that we could do short of a kind of an effort to just kind of transform society through a kind of top-down rewriting of our political order. And I do think we have historical practices that we are still within living memory. I think the idea of the township democracy that Alexis de Tocqueville witnessed in the 1830s is something that's still available to us. I mean, that's something we have to insist upon, and we have to insist upon having sufficient sort of skin in the game that there are things that we can actually do. I recognize that in a global society, there's probably limits to what we can do at the local level. But until we exercise our muscles, our civic muscles, our economic muscles, it strikes me that we are likely to continue to have a society in which we feel powerless, disempowered, and in some ways, in the midst of our individual liberty, completely unfree.
But the idea that we don't have power because the people who have the money have the great amount of power, that is a pervasive one in our political system, particularly when you look at the amounts of money that get thrown around. Short of changing the Constitution, are there ways that we can approach the level of money in politics, or is the approach more what you're talking about, deal with it locally first? I mean, the fact is that people do get awful upset about things in Washington when it is, in fact, the Planning Commission in their city that's probably going to affect their lives sooner.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's a kind of chicken and egg problem here, and I don't know the answer to this precisely, but I would at least put on the table that to the extent that we have, in some ways, we're complicit. We, the citizens, are complicit because we are shaped by this broader liberal order in which we want to be able to pursue our individual pursuits, our lives, the distinctive ways that we want to live our lives and not be too bothered with politics. We want people to do that work for us. So when you do put more and more politics into the center, and when you make it sort of the locus of that Washington, D.C., then all the money is going to pile into Washington, D.C. When all the action is in Washington, D.C., then there's no surprise that the richest eight counties in the richest eight counties in the country today, among the top 20 of the richest counties in the country today, are all around Washington, D.C. And they're not producing anything that I'm aware of. You know, it's not the hotbed of Silicon Valley and so forth. They're producing policy. So the money is flowing there because that's where the action, the political action is. If, in a way, if our politics were more decentralized, you would see a lot less money flowing to one place. And money's not going to cease to be important, but we can make it less concentrated. And one way to do that would be, to renew a sense of civic life that once existed in America, but which I think we, the citizens, have allowed, at least in part, allowed to flow out of our hands and to the center that's now located in Washington, D.C.
So here again, by exalting the rights of the individual, we can be as individuals as we want, but that also means we can disengage from each other and not necessarily work for a common good. There's a lot of stuff to think about in here. The book is called Why Liberalism Failed. It is by Patrick J. Deneen, an associate professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. Fascinating stuff. So much of the book we didn't even get a chance to touch upon, but great stuff to read. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, take it easy.